This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Donald Trump's enemies are happy that his administration seems to be falling apart at the seams. But Black political scholar Anthony Monteiro says it's not just Trump, but the whole capitalist imperial system that is in crisis. And we'll hear from an organizer with the new African Black Panther Party.
But first, 4 years ago, President Barack Obama gave the CIA authorization to arm and train Islamic jihadists to overthrow the government of Syria. Last month, President Donald Trump announced that the covert CIA proxy war program in Syria has been canceled. The Trump administration has also concluded agreements with Russia for ceasefires in several regions of Syria. We spoke with Ajamu Baraka, the veteran human rights activist and 2016 vice presidential candidate with the Green Party, who has been busy pulling together a Black Alliance for Peace.
Well, you know, Glenn, I think that second point is really actually the most important one. I mean, both of them are, of course, interconnected. But the fact that the Trump administration has moved significantly toward a correction in U.S. policy, that is one that, in essence, recognizes that the Obama war launched against Syria has basically failed, and that there needs to be a resolution so that they can go forward. And I think for Trump, what that means in terms of going forward is resolving that situation there in Syria, patching up relations with the Russians so that he can turn toward what I always have believed to be his number one strategic objective, and that is to build a relationship with Russia in opposition to the Chinese. But that's a whole nother conversation. But in terms of what is happening now with Syria, it's interesting to see what will be the response from the U.S. intelligence agencies. We see that the role that at least the three main ones have been playing, the CIA domestically, the FBI, of course, and the Defense Intelligence Agency, that basically they have been in opposition to the Trump presidency. We know that the intelligence agencies, in collaboration with the military forces on the ground in Syria, basically rebelled against the Obama ceasefire and sabotaged that back in September of 2016. So with the governmental crisis, it remains to be seen to what extent these elements of the quote-unquote deep state are actually going to obey that directive. And that, to me, is part of the historic situation we see here in the U.S., that you have an open rebellion against a sitting president who is attempting to try to provide command and control, if you will, direction to these various state agencies. And there's a question whether or not they, in fact, are going to abide by those directives.
Yes, there's been almost an ominous silence. Of course, officially, the CIA does not respond to lots of policy decisions. But unofficially, through leaks and using various political spokespersons who you know are talking for the CIA, and for demonstrations that can include things like unforeseen developments in various parts of the world that people attribute to the CIA gets to make its wishes known, and yet we don't know what their reaction is so far.
No, we don't, but we're going to see pretty soon. I think that the evidence will begin to emerge whether or not the direct participation of the CIA and the other intelligence elements will have changed. And that part of that will also be seen in terms of what kinds of response we'll see from, for example, the Saudis and even the Israelis, whether or not they're going to attempt to take up the space and continue to provide support to these jihadist elements. So we're going to see pretty soon what's going to unfold there. But it is, again, historic in the sense that there is now a more solid possibility for resolving this situation in Syria. Of course, you still have the issue, the fight right now in Raqqa, and the announcement on the part of the U.S. state that is going to remain in Syria even after that city is liberated. So, you know, you have all these moving parts of U.S. policy and that situation there in that country, and it really remains to be seen yet whether or not we are really on the road to real peace. Now, that situation with Raqqa and the announcement that the U.S. is going to remain in Syria, that is something else that needs to be unpackaged.
Yes, the U.S. Special Forces used to be known as the CIA's army, and there are about 1,000 of them currently helping the Iraqi Kurds in an operation that nominally is under the Pentagon, not the CIA. But Special Forces operating without the CIA, that's not the usual mode of operations in the U.S. military.
But, you know, Glenn, over the last few years, there's been that blending of CIA and Pentagon functions and operational activity. You saw that with General Petraeus. That General Petraeus, that movement that he made from the Pentagon to the CIA was reflective of the blurring of the lines between the CIA and the Pentagon. So we see that operationally, this kind of activity may be the new norm. Again, it's very interesting to watch this. It's also interesting to see the absence of any real debate on the part of the Congress regarding the announcement by the Trump administration that is going to remain in Syria. Not only do we see that announcement and, in fact, the participation, the involvement of the U.S. in Syria as a clear violation of international law, but if the U.S. military is going to be involved in sustained military action in Syria, one would think that that will require a support resolution from the U.S. Congress, at least under the War Powers Act. So it means that this sustained activity in Syria is also a potential violation of U.S. law. So we are seeing progress on one hand with the ceasefire and the attempts to have these de-escalation zones and to stop arming and training the jihadists. But on the other hand, we see that there is a new doctrine being developed with the U.S. determining that it's going to remain in Syria and perhaps establish the base that they wanted to establish in Iraq before they will push out of Iraq.
In some ways, the Syrian war is just an extension of the Libyan war. And in 2011, in the summer of 2011, the U.S. Congress had a chance to force President Obama to recognize the War Powers Act, but they did not.
No, they did not. And that collaboration with the Obama administration in clear violation of U.S. law, it's just another example of the lawlessness that we find with the U.S. Congress as it relates to supporting the agenda of the interests of the 1%, that this the doctrine of full spectrum dominance that's at the center, the core of U.S. global policy, that has to be supported no matter what. If it means violating international and U.S. law, then it appears that the U.S. Congress is prepared to do that along with the executive. So what we have, Glenn, again, is clear examples that the ruling class, the oligarchy in the U.S., is prepared to do whatever it needs to do in order to maintain its hegemony and to realize its objectives. And what that suggests that we have to do, that is the people, is one, we have to be educated on these situations. We should never allow ourselves to be confused like we were with Syria, where even so-called leftists fell right in line with U.S. policy and supporting some mythical revolutionary process and some propaganda-created Free Syrian Army that really confused the American people and provided support under the Obama administration for direct U.S. and indirect U.S. intervention in that country, with the result being millions of people displaced and hundreds of thousands of people losing their lives. So we have a responsibility in the North, in the U.S., to be as clear as possible, because when we aren't, when we allow the U.S. state to engage in these kinds of criminal adventures, then we are failing the people of the world, and we are, in fact, collaborating with criminality. So we've got to make sure that we never allow that to occur again.
The U.S. Congress has acted with unanimity in applying sanctions against Russia, supposedly because of alleged Russian meddling in U.S. elections. Unanimous, including, of course, all of the Congressional Black Caucus.
And, you know, it's interesting that even as these agreements were being discussed and negotiated, and we knew that they were coming, it seemed at the same time that's when there was an intensification on the part of various elements in Congress to ratchet up the pressure on Russia, to undermine the power of the executive, the president, that is, and being able to reverse the legislation that increased the sanctions. So it was almost as though any possibility of de-escalating the conflict in Syria, of having some kind of a more positive relationship with the Russians, was going to be undermined by congressional authority. And again, one has to ask the question, in whose interest is it? Why is it that the Congress and elements of the oligarchy are moving in the way that they are, in fact, moving? And I think one of the, obvious answers to that is that as long as you have the Russians as an enemy, then you have the debilitated rationale for making the arguments for these astronomical amounts of resources being squandered by the military budget, and which means that basically that direct transference of resources from the pockets of the American people into the pockets of the military-industrial complex continues. So it's significant that you keep Russia as the boogeyman, even though we know, or I believe, that the Russians can be replaced with a even more juicier boogeyman in the Chinese. But right now, they're concerned about maintaining that flow of money and not allowing any kind of discussion around whether or not there needs to be this incredible increase in the military budget. And for that, you need the Russian boogeyman in place.
We have a rather crazy situation in which the president would have to go to various congressional committees in order to get permission to weaken certain aspects of the sanctions regime that's been imposed. But because the War Powers Act is not being enforced, the president can make war against almost anybody at will. So we have a president who can make war at will, but cannot make peace with Russia through diminishment of sanctions at will.
That's not just strange. It's contradictory and it's almost surreal. But that, in fact, I think captures, in very graphic terms, what we have in place right now, the kind of not just confusion, but hypocrisy and exposure of the real interests of the U.S. state and its oligarchy, that you have these kinds of situations where a president can, in fact, make war, because war is part of the permanent agenda to try to maintain their hegemony. But if they want to reconcile with a belligerent nation or whatever, their hands are tied. So it is a crazy situation, but one that is understandable, was almost predictable, as the internal contradictions of this system of U.S. policy continue to sharpen. We see the resulting governmental crisis, which also is related to a policy crisis and an intellectual crisis, if you will.
We know that you're in motion as the main organizer of the Black Alliance for Peace, and that you'll be addressing the Black is Back Coalition's National Conference in Chicago on August 12th and 13th. How, in general, is the Black Alliance for Peace organizing effort going?
Well, in general, it's continuing because we are tapping into a sentiment among Black folks, a growing sentiment that the continuation of war that is seeing the squandering of resources, that's having the impact of developing inside of the U.S. society itself, that is the culture, this propensity for aggressive military actions from elements like the police, that this has to change, that there has to be some type of sanity brought back into the public square and to public discourse. And so people are responding. So we are continuing to build the infrastructure of the Black Alliance for Peace. We intend to ratchet up our position to this obscene request that came out of the Congress with bipartisan support to increase the U.S. military budget to $696 billion. You know, the Trump administration had proposed an increase of $54 billion. And so that was his proposal. And we thought that was obscene. And so the target was Trump. But now, with this coming out of the Congress, with significant numbers of Democrats in support of it, this is a bipartisan bill. This is not just Trump. This is a bipartisan bill committed to this obscene increase in military expenditure. So we're going to gear up for that. Almost all of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus supported that. So we want to educate their constituents in terms of the fact that the Congressional Black Caucus is right along with the other warmongers in squandering resources for the pursuit of war.
So if we go by the numbers, just adding up the dollars, Donald Trump is not an outlier. That the Congress is just as warlike, warmongering as he is.
The objective fact is that with this legislation that came out of Congress, it has shifted away from Donald Trump to, in fact, the Congress. And it has shifted to both of those bourgeois parties. So no, this is, again, them exposing their hand, that they are, in fact, committed to war, because this appears to be the only way in which they're going to be able to try to maintain their hegemony. Their legitimacy is shot both domestically and, in fact, internationally. So they are prepared to use the military option to maintain their dominance. That's why they're not only concerned with Russia, but you see the continued targeting of Iran. You see the saber rattling with North Korea. Again, that suits their purpose of justifying these military expenditures and diverting the attention of the American people away from domestic issues and domestic contradictions to the issue of the U.S. external threat. It's a very convenient place to be, a very convenient strategy. But what we are doing with the Black Alliance for Peace and working with other peace elements in this country is to shift the focus back to where it needs to be and to build a powerful anti-war movement in order for people to be in a place to take back the resources that are being stolen from them by these criminals in the U.S. state.
So the old excuse or explanation that Democrats in general and Black Democrats in particular were more likely to vote for the military under a Democratic and especially Black Democratic president really doesn't hold water. They'll vote for the military under a Republican that they hate as well.
That appears to be the case. And that's, I think, a result of the shift to the right that was effected by the Obama administration. That the Congressional Black Caucus, for example, they have ideological and psychological cover to be right with the rest of the right-wing warmongers and not pay a political price. So this is a graphic example of the shift that has occurred in the Black community, that these folks can engage in this kind of activity and up to this point not pay a political price. But there is still that germ of opposition there. And many of their constituents are not really following very closely these kinds of votes because they're so concerned with survival issues. Once they begin to see the collaboration of their representatives with an agenda that really in many ways has nothing to do with them, then we'll find that these folks may be a little bit more vulnerable than they might otherwise believe that they are.
Yes, that great change may not have occurred in the Black community in general or at large, but certainly within the Black political class.
Definitely, and because of the issues of non-accountability. That's why we've got to make these folks, in fact, accountable. I mean, up until we started trying to reorganize this Black Alliance for Peace, the last effort that was undertaken to try to build an anti-war movement in the U.S. was the Black Voices for Peace under Brother Donald Smith during the Bush administration. So it's been quite some time. So it's going to take some efforts. But I believe it's going to be, I wouldn't say easy, but I think we're going to make significant progress if we get the ability to get access to the people, which we've been doing. I just came off the road for 2 months. We're going to see that there is significant numbers of people who understand the hustle being played on them and are going to be quite upset. And they have been upset once they realize that their representatives are collaborating with these forces that are pursuing an agenda that is not only that has nothing to do with them, but counter to our interests.
That was Ajamu Baraka, former Green Party vice presidential candidate and organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace. Baraka is also an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report.
In recent years, and especially since the election of Barack Obama, the Democratic Party has equaled and often eclipsed the Republicans in their fervor for war. Few people would have predicted that the Democrats would become more warlike than a right-wing Republican like President Trump. Dr. Anthony Monteiro, the Du Boisian scholar based in Philadelphia, says the U.S. ruling class and its political system are in crisis, and Donald Trump is just a symptom of the decline.
Since his election and even before, you and I had been saying that his election would be a measure of how profound and deep the economic and political crisis in the nation was and is. And since January 20th, I think it's fair to say that the economic situation for the masses of people has worsened. Wages are stagnant. Over half of the American population either lives in poverty or close to it in a state of social and economic precarity. The white middle-aged, high school or less educated white people are the only group in the country to have shown a decline in population or an increase in mortality. The small industrial and manufacturing towns and medium-sized cities are spiraling into deeper social crisis with hospitals and schools and other public facilities closing, with water being contaminated and nothing these local governments can do about it. Austerity is the law of the land, and it is on this foundation of a social and economic crisis that the crisis of governance and of legitimacy has gotten worse. The party system, the two-party system that is disintegrating. Chuck Schumer, the head of the Democrats in the Senate, announced that Democrats are going to come out with an aggressive policy for jobs and wages and health care. And he acknowledges that a lot of what their program will be, they're taking from Trump's populism, which is to say that the Democrats are in a crisis. And the question is, will the party be able to ever regain power at the national level? One poll shows that 52% of the American public says that the Democrats do not have a plan to govern the nation. The Republican-controlled Senate and House passed more sanctions against Russia. Now, parenthetically, we should say the sanctions that are already in place have not really harmed Russia because of its move towards the east and away from the United States, dependence upon the United States. But the Republicans in the Senate and House have clearly made a move that goes in the opposite direction that Trump and his administration want vis-a-vis Russia, which is a sign of a party, again, on the Republican side, in disarray. So we're in a crisis of legitimacy, a crisis of governance, with a deepening crisis of everyday living for the majority of the American people. So as to 6 months into the Trump administration, things have gotten worse. People are more alienated from the governing class and, of course, from the ruling class itself. The question is, where do we go from here and what is to be done?
What seems clear is that the Trump regime is as pure a plutocracy as we have experienced yet in the United States. And the Democrats have no program at all except to run against the Russians.
Right. And see, this is part of the crisis of the Democratic Party. That's the only issue around which they can find common ground, if you will. And you're right. Trump and his people believe that something looking like a capitalist authoritarianism, a kind of what is generally associated with the Latin American strongman type of government is what is needed at this time. But the problem is that Trump doesn't have many allies anywhere in the deep state, in his own party, among the American people to establish such a strongman rule. And if he overreaches and attempts to take excessive power into the hands of his presidency, this will lead to a growing popular demand, which of course the deep state and the Democrats and Republicans will seize upon to move quickly to remove him from office through impeachment. So this is huge. We have never seen a crisis of this type. And again, we go back to the Civil War period and Lincoln and such. 11 states seceded from the nation, which caused a constitutional crisis, which led to the Civil War. But I don't think we've ever seen anything quite this deep, where this is a crisis of disintegration of the state, of the mechanisms of governance, and of course, of the party system, which produces the political leaders of the country, and the electoral system, which supposedly legitimates them. I don't think we've ever seen such a separation between the masses of people and the governing class. And this is where we are.
Yes, the disintegration of the state is not happening all by itself or just because of internal contradictions. It appears that Trump's opponents are hastening that disintegration in their zeal to get next to him, and that in reaction, even majorities of Democrats believe that this investigation of Trump mania, the Russia so-called gate, has gone too far and is actually harming the country. They seem to be talking about the legitimacy of the government.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And that's what the people are saying. I mean, they're saying that they're not concerned with Russia. They're concerned with jobs. They're concerned with education. They're concerned with health care and clean water and infrastructure development. And really, at the core of this, of their concerns, is their perception, which is based upon the reality that the wealth and income produced, the vast majority, 90% of it, produced since the Great Recession of 2008. 90% of the wealth and income produced in this period of recovery has gone to the 0.1%, to the financial oligarchs, to the wealthy part of the population. And they're saying that something radical and drastic has to be done. And that perception is not driven by ideology. It's driven by crisis, irrespective of whether one is a libertarian, a Republican, a Democrat, or either non-aligned with any political party. The economic crisis is driving a political crisis. Now, when you put that in the framework of a world that moves forward in spite of the crisis in the United States and in the West itself. And I think the last time we spoke, we were talking about the conference in China, in Beijing, the One Belt, One Road project, or the New Silk Road, depending on who's writing about this project, was literally endorsed by close to 100 countries at the summit in Beijing in June, where there were about 29 heads of state. And this symbolizes the fact that the center of the global economy has moved from Europe and North America to Asia. And at the core of this is a new set of institutions and economic relationships that would make the West, as it is called, a secondary or ancillary project or region to the world economy. That Asia, and I have suggested along with it, Africa, will in the second half of the 21st century constitute the center of the global economy. Now, this occurs at the same time that the political systems in China, in Russia, in Iran, and in North Korea are stable, while the political systems in the West, especially the United States, are unstable. The ratings of approval, for example, of the Putin government are somewhere near 85% in Russia. I would suggest similarly for Xi Jinping in China. And of course, the Iranians just had an election last year, and the government is stable and has the support of the majority of people in spite of the attempts of the United States and other countries to destabilize it. And of course, North Korea is very stable. So a new world is being born, and we should welcome it.
Now, you mentioned Africa as being part of that new preeminent economic area, but Africa, despite its mineral riches and potential, is virtually militarily occupied by the United States at present.
Well, that's true. But here we have a contradiction. You know, the United States, from the time of Africa's independence in the 1960s, had done everything possible to destabilize the continent, and especially the progressive governments. For example, the Congo, Ghana, Egypt, Guinea, Burkina Faso, and we could go on and on. And in the 2000s, the policy was military occupation, not just the United States, but also France. I think that in spite of that, the economic relationships between, for example, China and Africa are stronger now than they've ever been since the period of colonialism. Or let me put it another way. Since independence in Africa from the 1960s up till now, the economic relationships between China and Africa have never been this strong. And that includes relationships with South Africa, with the states of West Africa, with Ethiopia, the Horn of Africa, and on and on and on. So you have this contradiction between virtual military occupation on the one side, but then on the other side, growing economic ties with China and with this new emerging set of economic relationships between Asia and Africa. So that's what's happening going forward. I think that Africa will emerge as a part of the new world economic order on the side of China and Asia.
Well, certainly what you're describing is an imminent crisis then in Africa, as those militarized sectors that are clearly allied with the United States and dependent on it clash with those development-minded sectors of Africa who look forward to closer collaboration and cooperation with China and others in the Chinese growing economic sphere of influence.
Absolutely. And, you know, the country, I think, which best manifests this contradiction is the Democratic Republic of Congo, where Joseph Kabila is maneuvering and doing everything possible to prevent elections because he realizes that his pro-Western, pro-Paul Kagame policies are deeply unpopular in the Congo. And this unpopularity is not just among the poor peasantry and those in Eastern Congo who are under military occupation by Rwanda and warlords, but it is at the level of the elites, the business community, and even politicians that formerly had supported Joseph Kabila. The Congo is the largest, in terms of geography and territory, the largest nation in Africa, and probably the minerally richest country. So we see these clashes. I would say that Cote d'Ivoire is on the verge of another uprising against the French occupation and the government that the French installed there. So Africa is fluid politically. I think South Africa is in a political crisis, which is also a crisis of the ANC as the governing party, and in South Africa in particular, a deepening class conflict. I think, however, in the end, the forces of global transformation away from Western and American hegemony are so powerful that Africa will be swept into the whirlwind, and the masses in Africa, who are far more conscious, far more politically active than the Western media gives them credit for, will be a critical part of this new arrangement, of bringing it about, I should say.
The Trump administration announced what should be considered momentous news, if true, and that is that it has halted the CIA covert proxy war against Syria using these jihadist groups. But is this something that you have to see in order to believe?
Well, I believe it, and I think that the sanctions, the new sanctions imposed against Russia, are really directed at Trump. And are really, I think, triggered by the agreement with the Russians in Syria. I mean, what this agreement is saying is that the U.S. policy under Trump is no longer to overthrow the Assad government and to put in power jihadist and so-called moderate opposition forces. I think this is momentous because the war in Syria, which is not a civil war, it's an invasion to topple the government and so on, is but the first step to war with Iran. Now, of course, you know, the Trump presidency and Trump himself makes a lot of wild statements about Iran. But, you know, in a lot of ways, you can't have it both ways. You can't have peace in Syria and war in Iran. Peace in Syria strengthens Iran and its allies in that region. This is, of course, a big contradiction between the Trump administration and the Saudi regime, which wants a jihadist, Islamist regime in Syria. But I think what we see is a crumbling, again, I'll use the word disintegration, of the, quote, new world order based upon U.S. hegemonism. It is disintegrating. And the two great trends at this moment in world politics and in world history is, on the one side, the decline and perhaps disintegration of the power of the West and the rise of a new configuration, which is centered in Asia but is not exclusive to Asia.
But it seems that the only response of the West to the rise of China and the growing affinity between China and Russia is to foment more war and chaos. And the U.S. military has not had its say over the halt, the declared halt in the proxy war in Syria. And the CIA doesn't usually give up so easily.
That's true. I hear you. But I think what Syria indicates, and this is a lesson for those who want to go to war on the Korean Peninsula and those who want to go to war with Iran, that if the United States cannot in 6 years win in Syria, they certainly cannot win a war with Iran or with North Korea. in each instance, that is Iran and North Korea, a war which would be a prolonged conflict, would so damage the world economy as to produce a depression in the West. Let us not forget that North Korea is in a region where two of the three largest economies in the world are located, and three of the five largest economies in the world are located there. A prolonged war on the Korean Peninsula would also draw into it Japan. A war against Iran would immediately damage the movement of petroleum from the Persian Gulf to the West. There is no win, and these countries are not Iraq in 2003, and certainly not Syria. These are industrialized countries with powerful militaries and highly politicized and mobilized populations. So the war option is a last resort, and even the attempt to go to war would cause a great political and ideological conflict within the United States between those who seek to compete and cooperate economically with the developing forces in this new world configuration, with those who would want war to reestablish American hegemony. That would lead to something that looks like a civil war within the United States, and certainly would isolate and separate the United States from most of its European allies.
Well, where would this resistance to a war response to the decline of U.S. imperialism, where would that be centered? We see that the Democrats are the most active war party now, but the Republicans have been the war party forever, and it's very difficult to define Donald Trump.
This is the nature of politics in what many call the Trump era, because the options before the United States are either war to assert hegemony, which would be a losing proposition, I'm suggesting, or the rational thing, imperial retreat and cooperation with the forces of this new world economy and the institutions that are being built upon it, including the BRIC Bank, including the Asian Infrastructure Bank that's based in China, including a whole set of new types of political and economic and institutions that are not dependent upon the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, or Wall Street for that matter. I might just add to the whole equation, the chaos in Europe kicked off by the Brexit vote. How does the second largest economy in the European Union leave that union without doing permanent and deep damage to the whole European project? You can't do it. Everywhere you look in the West, there is crisis. And these are crises that cannot be resolved within the framework of the existing economic order. There will have to be, at some point, and I would suggest in the not that distant future, a rethinking of the U.S. and Euro-American role in the new world order, as it were.
That was Dr. Anthony Montero of the Black Radical Organizing Committee, speaking from Philadelphia.
The original Black Panther Party for Self-Defense has been defunct for decades, but its ideological children are still organizing, including within the U.S. prison system. The group called the New African Black Panther Party has established chapters in and outside the prisons. One of the party's prison chapters co-founders, Kevin Rashid Johnson, has been repeatedly transferred from penal facilities in Virginia, Oregon, and Texas as the authorities try to curtail his organizing activities. Fellow party members recently completely lost track of Johnson, who seemed to have disappeared into the vast American prison gulag. 2 weeks ago, Johnson's comrades located him in a Florida prison where he was being held in solitary confinement. Black Agenda radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with Tito Fish Rivera, another co-founder of the prison chapter of the New African Black Panther Party. He says the party has formed an interracial alliance.
The United Panther Movement is supposed to be built with the contingency of Black Panthers, White Panthers, Brown Panthers, and others who have already undergone a certain amount of political education, coming together as a intercommunal, internationalist movement, which is meant to deal with the entire challenge that working class and everyday people and poor people around the world are facing. So I share that with you because sometimes people don't understand that the layout that has come out, things that you'll find in the text Panther Vision, for instance, spell out the organization, the organizational methodology, the philosophy, the underlying principles, the rules, the do's and the don'ts of what this organization is meant to be. And that's what was being developed over the last 12 years, is the most advanced theoretical and practical political line built from the teachings and the writings of original Panthers, Black Panthers and such.
So when you say this organization being the New African Black Panther Party, is that
correct? The New African Black Panther Party, of which along the timeline has evolved into the Brown Panther Steering Committee, the White Panther Organizational Steering Committee, and the New African Black Panther Party.
Would you give your sense of where this particular series of reprisals began with Brother Kevin Rashid Johnson leading up to his recent transfer to Florida?
Well, let's keep in mind his original charges and his role in the community as a sophisticated organizer within the urban dynamic, somebody that was involved with various activities that would bring attention to him and his lumpen proletariat group of people that he was involved with. It's important to recognize that our people are under constant oppression. It's to recognize that this brother was in a predicament doing the best he could, given a life of oppression, a life of repression, a life of exploitation in society and the community that wanted him dead since birth. Now, once he entered the prison and he was able to take time to sit down and think, and some good brothers got around him and started to continue his education along the lines of what the Panther Party was about, Black nationalism, the revolutionary consciousness. While many people may be exposed to it, put it away or forget about it, he really took it serious and got into it. And that was admirable because he went through a form of personal restoration, personal redemption, and his process of realizing what were the contradictions that brought him to be in the position he was in. And with the courage and the strength in his heart, he continued that work by sharing it with other prisoners. And that's kind of where it goes from next, right? Because now, here you got a guy that was considered a menace to society, in prison, reformed politically, conscious, and deciding that he wants to help make other prisoners conscious. He's in touch with people from other prisons that are working in their prisons to help people be conscious. And as you can imagine, for some years, he had that quiet fight, that struggle, but very few people were aware of his situation. Very few people cared. Very few people could help. Over the years, the writings evolved. His capacity as a communicator, a speaker, a writer evolved, and his resistance to the system became stronger. And he started to fight as an army of one, right? Then got that saying, an army of one. He started to fight and resist the oppression, the techniques, the strategies that were coming against him inside of originally Virginia prisons. Then they transferred him to Texas, now to Florida, if I'm correct. all that occurred. And in that sense, whether it was hunger strikes, whether it was denying him medication, various tactics that are used against, you know, multiple political prisoners, prisoners of war, and those doing the work in the system. So the struggle continues, even to this very moment.
And in his recent write-up describing his travails around being transferred to Florida, he describes a tactic used by the Florida officials to designate the New African Black Panther Party as a violent street organization. Has that happened before with regard to your organization on the inside? And is there any response to that designation?
On the surface, we don't know what intelligence they feel that they have that would cause them to make that designation. However, historically, whenever you're more than two doing something that the system doesn't think they want to see you doing, they could consider that gang work. The fact that we work with gang members, ex-gang members, the fact that we work with people both inside and outside the prison system that maintains some sort of relationship to a street organization, this is all a concern to them, right? For me, I won't deny. The fact is, a lot of the young men that I came up with, eventually, for a limited set of reasons, may have chosen to join with the street organization. Now, does that mean that we promote criminal activity? Does that mean that we promote drugs, drug selling? I do not believe that we promote that. I believe that any member of our organization that turns a blind eye to the impact that drugs and prostitution and extortion have, especially when we do it to our own, is violating the basic principles of what this party is organized to do. But I also realize that we live in a dynamic, active situation, where there's people out there with lots of money and lots of resources and lots of time to sit back and figure out how they're going to block us, stop us, or control us. So this, along with a variety of other tactics that are currently being employed, has been what has caused us to have a slow grind, both inside and outside, when it comes to organizing this. Because we definitely don't want to fall into the same old traps that they've been setting for many generations.
What is the New African Black Panther Party asking of the general public with regard to Brother Kevin Rashid Johnson's conditions inside of the Florida prisons, and what kind of messaging should be sent out as regards his current plight?
Okay, well, he's still alive. He's struggling to get medicine he needs. We all know that if we make enough noise around any issue, we could get some things to change for the better. May not get him free right away, but ultimately that's our goal. You see, ultimately our goal is to empty out all the prisons, just like Nas said, right? You see, all of these prisoners are prisoners of an economic condition. In our time, ultimately we're calling for the total destruction of all of that, and that these prisons become schools. Schools to liberate the minds of these brothers and sisters. Schools to help them get the education they need so they can become effective and talented workers and parts of their community constructive. But until that time comes, we pick out certain people to focus on. And if one of the brothers that's been helping us to create this awareness, to help change lives and make things better, calls on us to send in a letter, send in some support, contact that prison, that little phone call should be of no great effort. That should be easy. So make that phone call. And beyond that, it's time to get involved. Whether you're black, white, red, brown, green, gray, I don't care what. It's time to get involved. Join with the group. Participate. Learn about what we're about. Come forward, ask some questions. And let's get this party started.
Kevin Rashid Johnson supporters ask that you write him. Kevin Johnson, 158039 FSP, P.O. Box 800, Rayford, Florida 3-2-0-8-3.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.